Ileana, good to talk with you again.
Thank you. Good to talk to you, too.
Do you believe in love at first sight?
Yes, I do.
I thought that was a better line to throw at you than you're messing with the wrong carny whore.
Yeah, well, you gotta start strong and finish strong is my motto.
That is certainly a great opening line for a character. I'm loving the brand new season of Goliath, and Rita is such a wonderful part of that show.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm having a blast. I mean, I was such a fan of the show already, and of Billy Bob Thornton. So it's just been... It was really fun to just even be on set working with Billy Bob and all the other amazing people in the cast, Paul Williams, Bo Bridges, Dennis Quaid, my God.
Yeah, it's an all-star team, my goodness. And I learned about it. I'd known about the show. I hadn't seen it. And then our friend Mark Duplass was on last season, and now I'm hooked.
He was great, too. I mean, when I was watching the show and then, you know, I had an opportunity to be on it, that kind of wonderful, quirky casting, it reminded me a little bit of the other show that I was on, 6 Feet Under. You know, wonderful veteran actors, and they really give you a chance to kind of dance and have fun. And as I said, I'm a fan of the show. And Rita occupies such an interesting, she's almost like the Greek chorus, you know, this barfly that is sort of aware of the things that are going on and helping out Billy Bob. So it was certainly fun.
And be careful what you say to Rita, because she takes it all in.
That's true. This year is about, you know, mortality. There's a lot of symbolism, and you know, it's interesting. People say, "Oh, that this year is a little like David Lynch." To me, there's a lot of Catholicism in it, and a lot of Native American influence in it. You know, believing in animal spirits and things like that. But he's at a point where he's questioning, you know, his life. And so he's basically seeing his life, you know, pass before his eyes while he's awake and the choices he's made. And so again, Rita, when I was going to do the part, I really saw her as, you know, a guardian angel in the way that in the movie, It's a Wonderful Life. She's like a wacky Clarence.
Well, I'm only 3 episodes in, so I don't want any spoilers here, but I love it so far. I don't know what Graham Greene is putting in those pipes, but it leads to some some interesting things. I love the Dennis Quaid music sequence early in the season. Was just fabulous.
It's just great. Like I said, for me, just to be in the show and to get to work with all these people that I really admire, and I've seen them in so many other great films, that's what's so exciting for me. But again, part of the fun of the show is that I think they really let Lawrence Trilling, who's the director and showrunner, just really lets everybody kind of go for it and then edits, you know, what is good or not good. But we certainly had a great time on the set, I have to say. As soon as people would call cut, everybody would launch into some great showbiz story. So that's sort of my favorite thing.
Well, and the writing.
In fact, Bo, the connection I have with Bo Bridges was that he and my grandfather were actually in this show back in the 70s that his dad was in, where they played, you know, Benjamin Franklin, and they played all the, you know, the presidents. The different presidents. And Bo Bridges, believe it or not, played a young Benjamin Franklin in the show. So he played a young my grandfather. So we had that fun connection.
Wow. Well, the writing is great, but I'm so impressed with the cinematography. And several other people have said this. It's really got that cinematic feel to it.
Right. Like, you would call it a neo-noir because it's so stylized. but it's never so what I love about it is it's never so stylized that it takes you out of the show.
Right.
But these beautiful vistas of the Central Valley and some of the overhead shots of the crops and the crop fields. You know, we live here in Los Angeles, and, you know, I've often spent time in San Francisco, but it's the kind of thing, I've never been to Sacramento, and it's such a gigantic state, and it's that realization that they say in the show, most of the water from the Central Valley is being pumped down here to Los Angeles and to the cities. And we don't really know much about what's going on in the farmland in the Central Valley of Connecticut.
We're talking with Ileana Douglas here on Downtown California, indeed. I also want to talk about the wonderful podcast that you do Thursdays, 3 o'clock Pacific time, The Film Scene. How did that come about?
Well, I'd been doing my podcast, which was based on my book called I Blame Dennis Hopper. And I was finding that the most fun I was having was not only interviewing people about, you know, things that they'd done in the arc of their career, but really kind of getting down and dirty and, you know, talking about one film for an hour. And I wanted the show to be more reflective of that. And I also wanted the ability to talk about contemporary films and have people on that are making movies now, because I still, although I'm a classic film lover, I'm out there every weekend and every night watching all the films that are around. So, and sometimes, you know, I just think my perspective on films is a little unique. And I also wanted to get into interviewing authors quite a bit. And of course, we still have, you know, fun people on. Like next week, we're having Moby on, who I lassoed into being in an independent film that I did called Pittsburgh with Jeff Goldblum. So it still occupies that crazy world of, you know, my movies that I've been in and people that I've known through movies that I've been in. But then, as I said, in addition, adding in authors, because, you know, I read a lot, and to me, I just wanted to bring in more authors and talking about more contemporary films. So it's more inclusive for the audience.
Did I see somewhere on social media that you're working on another book?
I am working on another book. It's been a lot harder just because I had more free time to work on the first book. And the second one, I took on a task of writing another book that is a movie book that I, you know, became more passionate about. When, you know, writing about my own life is always, as people know, is a little bit more of a struggle. So, of course, I took on the task of writing a movie book because that was a lot more fun. So, but hopefully both books will be out within the next couple of years, because I do enjoy writing, and, you know, I love the response to I Blame Dennis Hopper, and I still have a lot more stories that I want to write about, but taking them in a crazier way, like Goliath, you know. You establish the first season, and then you get wacky.
I went back and reread the book, and I loved it every bit as much as when I read it the first time. And
thank you.
I keep going back to the story, and I don't believe we talked about it the first time you were on. Can you share a little bit of the story of your adventure with Marlon Brando?
Well, the book, the basis of the book is the idea of how, you know, one movie or one movie star really changed, you know, the direction of my life. And that was, you know, my parents seeing Dennis Hopper and Easy Rider, and how that shaped the direction of my life. And I really feel movies do that for us. We see things in the film and gives us just the strength, or we identify with somebody and, you know, we make changes in our own life. And Marlon Brando, for me, was just somebody I admired so much, and I had the opportunity to meet him midway through my career. And the point of the story was he was so famous, I didn't even want to meet him, but he kind of took a liking to me, and he ended up christening me with a new name. You know, he said that I was like an intuitive sort of empath, and he said I was a tuning fork. So that became a really interesting, sort of name, you know, name, the way he named me in that way. I never had an idea of who I was before. And it started me on a path of kind of believing in myself, because if Marlon Brando thought I was important, then, you know, maybe I was important. And so oftentimes I think that's sort of the theme of the book, is that you, even if you don't think of yourself as an important person, you know, sometimes people come along and you have to be aware of these moments. Now, it was also very funny because, you know, then after I met him, he sent me flowers and invited me over to his house, and I had to make a decision of whether I was going to do that or not. But I always do. I count it as one of my biggest showbiz regrets that I did not go to his house.
You've done such a wonderful job through your work at TCM, educating film viewers about the history of women in film and those pioneering women. What happened in the early days? There were a lot of women who were involved as directors, as screenwriters, and then kind of went away for a while. Was it the studio system that really held women back through those middle years in film history?
Well, the general consensus is that as soon as people thought that there was going to be money involved, and there's another great documentary out, we actually had her on the show, by Pam Green, about Alice Guy Blaché, who was the first female director, we think, made a movie in 1896 called The Cabbage Fairy, which people believe might be the first narrative film, meaning it had an actual story. They wasn't just photographing things. So I think the idea is that the turn of the century, you know, things like photography, it was just an artsy thing to do, and women were, you know, doing things creatively and writing little stories and things like that. But the minute that the public started flocking to these films, that's when all the, you know, men kind of got together and pushed all the women out. Now, some of this is the idea that the women were, you know, were married to men, and men, their husbands oftentimes took the credit. In some instances, women were continuing to work. They just were working in the shadow of their husband, and their husband would get all the credit, you know, and we never heard about any of the women. But again, for some, there's a very interesting moment in her film where she interviews Peter Bogdanovich, who's a film historian and who, you know, wrote primarily, again, about the contributions of, you know, male directors, but never had any women. And, you know, he says he just never heard of any of these women, which I find kind of hard to believe. But now, again, all these films are being discovered around the world, and they're being, you know, reproduced. However, we still have the stigma of, as I'm always saying, there are no female-directed films on the AFI Top 100 list. We still look at women's films as lesser than a man's films. And I don't know what it's going to take to change that. You know, it's just baked into the society. But we're discovering a lot of these women now, you know, Alice Guy Blaché and Lois Weber, who was part of, you know, this Kino Lorber set that won all sorts of awards last year. And so people are discovering now that the movies can be, you know, fixed up and preserved, how wonderful. I mean, they were doing all of these things, tinting and close-ups and dissolves and all these interesting things that we only attributed to people, you know, like D.W. Griffith. So we're going to have to reassess, and that's always very hard in the history books, you know, to kind of, how do we reassess the women? Because, again, the narrative was always, oh, there was Dorothy Arzner in the 30s, and then there was, you know, Ida Lupino in the 50s, and then there was Elaine May. Now, that was what I was always taught. So it was quite a revelation when we started doing Trailblazing Women to think, oh, my God, there are hundreds of female writer, producer, directors, and I've never heard of them. So you have to think that there was a concerted effort. One of the things that is tragic in this documentary is this man, Gaumont, who ran the film studio in Paris. He asked Alice Guy Blaché for all, you know, they're writing a book about the history of Gaumont, and she worked there and started out as the secretary, and she gave him all of her notes. Well, guess what? They wrote the book using her notes, and they didn't even include her in the book. So, you know, when you say, well, why were they, you know, there seems to be, again, a concerted effort again and again and again to not give women the proper credit for what they've done. And I don't really know why that is, but it still happens. It happens to this day. Or we negate their contributions. As I said, you know, a movie like A League of Their Own, directed by Penny Marshall, if a man had directed that film, it would be on the AFI Top 100 list. There's no doubt in my mind.
What did David Byrne say? Same as it ever was.
Yes. Yeah. It's, and this happens in other, you know, realms too, but specifically in films are such a collaborative thing, but it's very, you know, it's challenging when after the fact, now we have to introduce all these, you know, new female filmmakers. And then the last thing, of course, is that because they were pushed out, you know, they didn't amass the body of work that some of these other people did. You know, Raoul Walsh started out as an actor in silent films, and then, you know, he lost his eye in a car accident, and then he moved into directing, and he directed, and he had a very long career. A lot of these women were acting in silent films, writing and producing, and then suddenly, boom, they weren't allowed to direct anymore. There was this glorious period, you know, that Universal really prided itself on having all these female directors. But again, around the early 20s, this completely goes away and, you know, none of the women are working anymore. But what was interesting was that a lot of their husbands continued to work, and they contributed to their husbands' films. I mean, that's what's very interesting. Every time you read a book, whether it's about Alfred Hitchcock or Fritz Lang or Michael Curtiz, all you ever hear about is behind the scenes, you know, the contributions that, you know, that their wives were making. And there's a book that's coming out on Joan Harrison, who behind the scenes helped create, you know, the Hitchcock brand.
Right.
And was possibly the muse for, you know, what became his archetypal, you know, female protagonist, the cool blonde. It's her. But when she stepped away, you know, after they did Rebecca and they did all their early Hollywood films working with David Selznick, when she went on her own, nobody took her seriously because she never got a proper credit. You know, people thought she was Hitchcock's assistant or maybe his girlfriend, and it was really upsetting. Even screenwriters who work with Hitchcock kind of poo-pooed her contributions. fascinating, even though she did. I mean, the reality is she did a lot, but when people were questions about her, they said, oh, well, she didn't really, you know, Hitchcock liked her, and that's the only reason she was working. So, and anyway, it's, you know, you hear it time and again, and I'm not really sure why, you know, why that is. I think that it's something, you know, that still goes on today, where women just, you know, they jump in and they're helping out, and then they realize along the way that they didn't, you know, that they're not getting the proper credit. I still think to this day, we have a really hard time believing that a woman, you know, did something.
What is,
I don't know why that is.
I can think of all kinds of reasons, starting at the top, for goodness sakes. What's a film that you love to introduce to friends?
Oh, goodness gracious. I mean, there's so many. I have been, you know, I'm a guru on Joe Dante's, got a web series called Trailers from Hell.
Yeah, I love that.
And and there's a couple that are coming up. One I reintroduced is actually To Die For, which is not as easy to be seen these days. I'm not really sure why. It was a Columbia film that I was in with Nicole Kidman. But I think it's one of the first, you know, films that really examined the idea of you aren't anybody unless you were on television. And this came out around 1993, based on the Pamela Smart case, and early film of Gus Van Sant. And I just think it's, you know, a really interesting game, a movie within a movie, implying, all, you know, it's got a documentary in the middle. It just foretells a lot of interesting things. And then the other movies that I've been really interested in, I mentioned Fritz Lang, but I'm a huge Glenn Ford fan.
Oh, he was great.
I'm always pressing on really how good Glenn Ford is. And there's a movie he did called Human Nature, a Fritz Lang movie, that I think is fantastic. And so Fritz Lang did a movie called Clash by Night, which I love. Marilyn Monroe is in that, Barbara Stanwyck. And he also did The Big Heat. Mm. That's the one that people really mainly know him for. I mean, he did silent films, like Metropolis,
yeah.
Amazing. But his movies that he did in Hollywood, I just think they're really, really fascinating. There's this early period. Criterion, a few months ago, they did a series called Columbia Noirs, which is a whole interesting thing. Like, when we think of noirs, we always think of RKO. But Columbia, up until the early 60s, you know, made some really, really interesting noirs, and they showed all of them. And my God, I was riveted. There was a lot of movies I'd never seen before. You know, directors like Don Siegel, and that was fascinating. So all those Columbia noirs are great, but Fritz Lang I've really, really gotten into lately. So those are the ones that I've been kind of talking about with friends and recommending.
See, the one I recommend to people is Grace of My Heart, which I absolutely love. And I've got it on DVD, and I rewatch it on a regular basis. The ensemble is great. The direction is fantastic. And it's just one of my all-time favorite movies.
Oh, thanks. Well, Allison and I, we've been really, you know, we've been working behind the scenes, you know, going back to what we said about, you know, lost films and, you know, women not getting credit. I mean, we really want to see the movie restored. There's only, you know, one print that even exists of the film that's in storage. And, you know, Allison and I go around the world showing this film when there's only one print, and there's additional scenes that we shot that we would like to get restored, and you know, we really would love for somebody like Criterion or Arrow to do a restoration and a re-release of it, because it really is our, you know, our legacy film, something that we collaborated on together. And there's so many important details to it, things having to do with music and behind the scenes. And so there's a lot of really interesting stories. The collaboration, you know, with our executive producer, Martin Scorsese, and how that all came about. And editing by Thelma Schoonmaker, who never really steps away from working with Marty, right, although she did on this film. So there's a lot of really interesting kind of components to the film that I think make it worthy of a restoration and a re-release. Plus, fans love it. I love it. You know, it's not a perfect film, but it's certainly got some flaws in it. We had a really limited budget, but I think that there's so many interesting qualities to it. And Allison and I always, there's a couple scenes we would love to see restored. And I think it would be great, because we didn't want to see them cut, and they were cut. We could even, you know, we could talk about why they were cut. But, so we're looking into that. I don't know. That may be a crowd. That may be a, you know, a crowdfunding kind of a thing to get Race of My Heart restored.
Sign
we'll
me
get
up.
You in charge of that.
Sign me up when that happens. It's funny. We won't keep you too long, but we were talking about film noir, and I happened to catch two or three weeks ago, maybe, one of my favorite from that time period in that genre, Pick Up on South Street. And I was reminded of how great, and I'm not just saying it because you're here, but like you, Thelma Ritter, one of those actors who just makes every movie she's in better by her presence.
Incredible, yeah. I believe, I'm not sure about this, but didn't she come out of vaudeville? Didn't she?
I think she did, yeah.
Actually, and what's interesting is she's in the movie All About Eve, her character says that she came out of aught, you know, that she was born in a trunk. Mm. So I'm not really sure if that's true, but I think it's true. And yeah, she's incredible all the way to, you know, then Misfits.
Yeah.
I agree with you. She always...
Rear Window. Oh, my word.
Rear Window. Yeah. No, she always, you know, added something. And she was great. Oh, all these great character actors who we barely... You know they're Edmund O'Brien, you know, these people that are in the third lead that add so much to a movie. I always love Dan Duryea.
Oh gosh, yeah.
My favorites. He's so creepy. He's got that great creepy voice, and he just, you know, as soon as I see Dan Duryea in something, I go, this is not gonna be Dan Duryea. I mean, here's another movie.
I just caught him on a Twilight Zone recently, and it was great.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen Dan Duryea in The Little Foxes?
Yes. Yes.
How great is Dan Duryea in The Little Foxes? God, I love that movie. Whenever that film is on, I love that film. That is a gem of a movie that has really, really grown on me.
And he just disappears so completely into that role that you don't even think that this guy's acting.
Yeah. And it's different than some of the other things that he's done, you know, because you usually see him in these noirs. But, yeah, that I think that's my favorite Dan Duryea sleazy performance, you know. Poor guy. He's probably a super nice guy.
Well, Ileana, I could talk movies with you all day. It's so great to have the chance to talk with you again. Can't wait to see what happens to Rita as I watch the rest of season 3 of Goliath.
I know. I can't. Yeah. I mean, well, people have been loving it and quoting Rita. So that's really exciting to do something that the fans like. So I hope everybody continues to watch Goliath and support it, because it's just a fantastic artistic show, and I had a blast doing it.
It sure is. And great to talk with you again. Thanks so much, Ileana.
Thank you. Have a great day.